Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Merciful, the Most Beneficent, I would like to begin today's lecture program, which is the third in the series of lecture that will continue until the 15th of September or the 26th of Muharram. Speaking to us again today will be Sheikh Hamza Saudagar, who will be continuing on the topic of the special companions of our Imams. He has spoken previously about Hazrat Salman al-Farisi in his first lecture and the responsibility that came with it and the social and political responsibility and his obedience towards the Imam. And then in the second lecture, we spoke about Hazrat Ammar Yasir yesterday and how his vision and insight is crucial and how we can learn to gain insight in a time where things can be politically confusing. As usual, we will have a question and answer session after the lecture concludes. We begin with the recitation of the Quran and a salam, which will be preceded then by the lecture. And afterwards, we'll have a small naha and then finally the question and answer session. If you have any questions that remain from yesterday, I would like you to send them to our host, Babul Ilm Society, and any questions that may arise during the lecture, I would also encourage everyone to send their questions on so the Sheikh may be able to answer them today. Thank you for being here. And first of all, I would like to invite Brother Hussein Mehdi to come and start us off with the recitation of the Holy Quran.
Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam.
Suratul Ikhlas Makiyya. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Qul huwallahu ahad. الله السمد لم يلد ولم يولد ولم يقل له كفوا أحد صدق الله العلي العظيم.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم. Thank you, Hussein, for your recitation of Surah Al-Ikhlas. A reaffirmation of the oneness and the tawheed of Allah. Next up, I would like to invite Brother Khurshid Mirza, Khurshid Abbas. I don't know why I keep saying Mirza. Khurshid Abbas to come forward and recite the salam for us. Khurshid, maybe. No?
Assalamu alaikum.
As-salam.
Bawzi blunt salawat.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad wa ajil farajahum.
Salli ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad wa ajil. शाम की और तो एक वादा करो शाम की और तो एक वादा करो रोज कब्रे सकीना पे आओगी तुम शाम की और तो एक वादा करो जब तलक लौट कर मैं ना आऊं आके शमा जलाओगी तुम शाम की और तो एक वादा करो सूरत शाहिदी बेकफन भी मेरे जैसी असीर महन भी खाली कुर्ते में मदफून गुर्बत मिसल असगर रही बेकफन भी क्या कफन की तरह रोज चादर इस लहद पर चढ़ाओगी तुम शाम की और तो एक वादा करो एक यसरब की थी शाहजादी उसका सबका था अब्बास गाजी مشکلے کر گیا سو دریا اور قبضے میں کر لی ترائی لوریوں میں یہ سچی کہانی روز اس کو سناؤ گی تم شام کی اور تو ایک وعدہ کرو شام کی اور تو ایک وعدہ کرو ہم نے زندہ سے پائی رہائی اب بہن پاس ہوگی نا بھائی بات اتنی سی بس یاد رکھنا میری بچی ہے غم کی ستائی تم نے بازار میں تو ستایا اب نہ اس کو ستاؤ گی تم شام کی اور تو ایک وعدہ کرو شام کی اور تو ایک وعدہ کرو روز قبر سکینہ پہ آؤ گی تم شام کی اور تو ایک وعدہ کرو جب تلک لوٹ کر میں نہ آؤں آ کے شمع جلاؤ گی تم شام کی اور تو ایک وعدہ کرو آواز بلند صلوات
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم. The masaib of Bibi Sakina are truly heart-wrenching, ones that can break even the hardest and most stone-cold of hearts. Because once we pay particular attention to this, not only was she treated like a princess, not only was she this main receiver of Imam Hussein's love, where she would sleep on his chest, then Imam Hussein loved her very like openly and visibly. It's the cruel treatment that she received after his martyrdom, where even she would hide her ears. And every dhulm and every oppression and every atrocity was committed upon her. And it shatters your hearts, especially when you go back and you think that it was her grandfather, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, who would spend his nights in Kufa, carrying sacks of food, feeding the yatima, making, you know, he was the man who would tell the yatim of Kufa, if somebody says you don't have a father, tell them your father is Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib. So Karbala does a great amount to show us, yes, the heroic sacrifice of the Imam, but it also helps us deface these oppressors. It also helps us unmask them and identify them, because even today we can see that these oppressors don't have any regard for children or women or those that are seemingly, according to society, weaker than them. And we can see this in the likes of Yemen, in the oppression that the Palestinians face every day. And without further ado, now I would like to invite Sheikh Hamza Saudagar to continue his series of lectures. And I would also like to remind all of you, any questions that may have been left over from yesterday or any that may arise during the lecture today, please do send them to the host so that we may be able to answer them during the question and answer session preceding the majlis. Thank you very much, Sheikh. You may begin now if you are here.
السلام عليكم ورحمة
الله. وعليكم السلام ورحمة الله.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين بارئ الخلائق أجمعين باعث الأنبياء والمرسلين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا ونبينا وحبيب قلوبنا وطبيب نفوسنا وشفيع ذنوبنا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المكرمين المنتجبين لا سيما بقية الله في الأراضين روحي وأرواح العالمين لتراب مقدمه الفداء ولعنة الله على أعدائهم أجمعين إلى قيام يوم الدين. For the hastening return of our Imam, let's recite the salawat. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad wa ala jail faraja. Today we would like to discuss a little bit and talk very briefly on the character known as Malik al-Ashtar al-Nakhai. This companion whose heroic chivalry in the battles accompanying Amir al-Mu'mineen are well known to the lovers of Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali ibn Abi Talib, salamullah alayhi, one whom, unlike the chivalries, but the love of Amir al-Mu'mineen for him, the way he regarded him, he saw him, and mentioned him after his shahada, after his martyrdom, which was a very sad and difficult one, as this brave, great man was martyred in a cowardly way through poison. Amir al-Mu'mineen spoke of him afterwards and described him in ways that are truly cause a person to be envious of such a great figure that Amir al-Mu'mineen describes in such a way. Those words are found in Nahj al-Balagha. There's various aspects of Malik that can be discussed and should be discussed. Let me say a little something about him that is, I believe, less known. From the readings of history, it becomes evident that Malik was actually not one of, first of all, he's not one of the Ashab of the Prophet, unlike the two previous characters that we discussed, Salman and also Ammar. These were both companions of the Prophet, then later companions of Amir al-Mu'mineen, salamullah alayhi. Malik is not a companion of the Prophet. He is referred to as a tabi'i. A tabi'i is a person who has met with and spent time with the companions of the Prophet, but has not himself been or herself been a companion of the Holy Prophet. And he did not live in Medina, again, unlike Salman and Ammar, who spent time in Medina. Malik didn't spend time in Medina from the accounts that we have seen. He spent time in Kufa, he lived in Kufa. And his knowledge of Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali ibn Abi Talib, salamullah alayhi, and his liking of Ali ibn Abi Talib before the rebellion against Uthman is not very well known. Or in other words, it's not very well documented, so we don't really know to what degree he was aware of such an imam and to what degree he believed that he needs to be followed. From some of what he has said and done during the rebellion against Uthman, it is clear to at least myself that he was not someone that was aware of the position of Ali ibn Abi Talib in the Ummah of the Prophet after the demise of the Prophet, just like most people were not. They were not made aware. The authorities obviously didn't want to share that. They didn't want people to know that. They didn't want people to believe that. And the companions, one way or another, were told or forced or in whatever other way, did not share the greatness of Amir al-Mu'mineen during that period. And even if they did, some of his chivalry and talking about some of the battles, perhaps his name being mentioned and the great services that he provided Islam and the Muslimin and beyond all the Holy Prophet may have been mentioned, but the position and the rank of Ali ibn Abi Talib to the Muslimin after the demise of the Prophet and that he is the rightful ruler. That was something that was not discussed, and therefore Malik is someone that is not aware of that, and he does not follow and or even come to Ali ibn Abi Talib initially as someone that he must obey. He didn't see Ali ibn Abi Talib in that way. Unlike Salman and Ammar, he's someone that was not as aware. In the process of the rebellion against Uthman, the third Khalifa, which is an important period in our history, there was rebellion. The corruptions of the third Khalifa were causing a lot of unrest. People were very upset. Right before their eyes, whatever was left of the justice system of the Prophet's time in regards to the distribution of the public funds that were belonging to the Muslimin and they needed to be distributed equally, whatever was left up to the time of Uthman's government, eventually that became worse and worse, and the discrimination against people and the favoritism that was there towards some of those who were close to the Prophet, some of those who identified as the companions of the Prophet, and more so those who were related to Uthman himself. The closer you were to the Khalifa, the more of those funds you had access to, and you could pretty much do whatever you wanted. And this was evident, and people saw. And obviously this type of behavior, this type of conduct was unacceptable by the masses on one level. Obviously they want some of those resources. Many of them are struggling, comparatively at least. They don't have access to them. They're struggling for their day-to-day means. And then they see that these people, just because they're related to the Khalifa, they have access to all these funds, and they have heard that these funds belong to the Muslimin according to Islamic law. And then on a higher level, there was a lot of unease and disagreement, or where people were very upset at him amongst the companions of the Prophet and some of the Tabi'een. So eventually a rebellion started up from two major centers in the Islamic Empire. One was Egypt, Misr, and the other was Kufa. One of the major players in the rebellion from Kufa was Malik al-Ashtar al-Nakhai. He was a person who was involved in that rebellion. He wasn't responsible for the death of Uthman, but he was involved in rebelling against the oppressions of Uthman. They came to Medina to deal with it and to get Uthman to change his ways. Uthman didn't change his ways. Some others gathered and they killed Uthman. But the act of gathering people to try to change the way things are was something that Malik al-Ashtar was involved in. And then when Amir al-Mu'mineen started the process of preparing the different areas, setting governors for different regions, eventually the issue of Jamal came up, and one of those who joined Amir al-Mu'mineen in the matter of Jamal to respond to the rebellion of Talha and Zubayr for their material objectives was Malik al-Ashtar. Remember yesterday we mentioned something about the Masjid of Kufa, the Jami' in Kufa, where Imam al-Mujtaba and Ammar were speaking to the people in regards to gathering troops for the Battle of Jamal. Malik was there as well. He played a different role. Not right at the moment when this was happening, but when the conversations were taking place, eventually Malik came in, and obviously Malik was known as a very strong and brave warrior. And he was known to be now on the side of Ali ibn Abi Talib, Amir al-Mu'mineen. And he came there in support. And once Abu Musa al-Ash'ari, the Mal'un, saw Malik come in and saw that, I guess Malik was angry at Abu Musa al-Ash'ari. And I'll tell you why in a little bit. As soon as he came in and Abu Musa al-Ash'ari saw Malik's face, the anger, he ran. And that was the end of that chapter. So the words of Imam al-Mujtaba, the words of Ammar, and then the presence of someone like Malik caused the people to completely disregard Abu Musa al-Ash'ari. And the reason why Malik was very angry at Abu Musa al-Ash'ari is because Malik was the one that recommended to Amir al-Mu'mineen to have Abu Musa al-Ash'ari as the governor of Kufa. And now he's behaving in this way. So Malik is very angry at him because he sees him as someone who has betrayed the trust of Malik and Amir al-Mu'mineen. And he probably feels resentment towards recommending him as the governor of Kufa. Anyhow, and then in the Battle of Siffin, my understanding is that in the process of the Battle of Siffin is where Malik ascended to the rank of one of the special companions of Amir al-Mu'mineen. There are different factors. I can't really discuss the details of what I mean by that, in which scenario and in which condition, which part of the battle, what was said, what was done. But eventually, during the process of this Battle of Siffin, Malik, who had seen Amir al-Mu'mineen as a great person, as a companion of the Prophet, as a just person, all these good qualities he knew in regards to Amir al-Mu'mineen. But it seems to me that his understanding of Amir al-Mu'mineen up to that point was simply a normal person with these good qualities. A normal companion, just like anyone else, it's just that he's a little better. He's not after the material gains and the glamour of this material realm. And he acts justly, he's spiritual, all of these things, but an average person. Not someone that whatever he says, you need to obey. Initially, some of the events that took place in the Battle of Siffin tell me that while he respected Amir al-Mu'mineen, he considered him the Khalifa, he went along with him in those battles and so on, he didn't see Ali ibn Abi Talib as someone that he needs to obey in every word he says at that point in the initial stages. But, you know, the Battle of Siffin took over 6 months. This was a training ground for Malik. He was trained through the process of this battle, and he came to where he reached that point. And that's the part of what we want to discuss here. Let's see what we can call it in the end as the quality that we find in Malik that is important, and we need to try to take that, learn that, and try to implement that in ourselves, try to develop that in ourselves. It's a very, very important quality. Malik was the leading general of Amir al-Mu'mineen's army. Amir al-Mu'mineen deliberately in Siffin did not send Imam al-Hasan and Imam al-Husayn as generals to fight in the battle. There are reasons, different scholars have identified different reasons from the words of Amir al-Mu'mineen himself, but it's clear that while Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein were there, they were not sent as generals leading the people against Muawiyah for various reasons. The top general that was leading the companions of Amir al-Mu'mineen in the Battle of Siffin against Muawiyah was Malik. The final day of the battle, we've all heard this story. I want to focus on this piece and see what we can understand from it and what we can learn from this great companion. It's a very difficult scene, by the way. To understand it, let me just present it very briefly so we know what scene I'm talking about. Everybody knows this, and that is right before the Qur'ans were set on the spears, what happened was that Malik was advancing towards the tent of Muawiyah. And so they pulled off this trick of putting up the Qur'ans on the spears because they were trying to escape imminent death. Okay, it was coming to that. They were going to get killed. So they looked for some strategy, some tactics, something to pull off and to escape this condition. And that was what they did. And it worked, unfortunately. But at that point, Malik was close, was very close. He had made his way to the tent of Muawiyah. He could see the tent of Muawiyah. This is the scene. We want to, and then obviously everyone knows Amir al-Mu'mineen tells him to come back, and he comes back. There's some details right now I'm not addressing. I'm going to get back to that. But to understand the state of mind that Malik is in, a couple of things need to be considered. One is, this was a very difficult battle. As we said, it took up over 6 months. It doesn't mean 6 months of fighting every single day. They moved to Siffin, which is far away from their hometown. Siffin is somewhere in northern Iraq, east of Syria, somewhere by the border there, if I get the location roughly. This is not a very accurate, I haven't been able to pinpoint exactly where it is. I haven't seen it on the map, but from the descriptions, it's somewhere there. It's not very close to. And the climate is different than Kufa that these people are familiar with. They arrive there, they set up camp, different things have happened. It's taken some time for the battle to begin. The battle has been paused. They had hit the months of Haram, the months that have special respect you cannot fight in. People did not fight during those months, but they stayed there. This getting dragged, the longest battle that was fought during the time of the Holy Prophet was the Battle of Ahzab, and that took a month. It was a month long. This has taken 6 months. They've been away from home, away from family. It's dragged on. People have lost in different smaller battles that have taken place, and then they've stopped, paused, and then re-engaged again. People have lost loved ones. People are complaining about the conditions. As a commander and one of the leading figures of the army of Amir al-Mu'mineen, coming to a victory in these conditions especially is very important. Malik also understands the problem of Muawiyah. He is up to this point now has understood, although from the beginning it seems like he was one of the advocates of going after Muawiyah. Some of those around Amir al-Mu'mineen were interested in leaving Muawiyah to himself. It seems like Malik was not one of them. So he understood the problem of Muawiyah and that it needs to be dealt with. So that's an additional factor to have this urge, this want, this strong desire to get rid of Muawiyah and to defeat Muawiyah. Keep all that in mind. Now he has been able to, with his soldiers, with his fleet, he's been able to advance towards it, and he can see the tent of Muawiyah. He can see that devilish smile on Muawiyah's face accompanied with fear. He can see both of those. When he sees the Qur'ans on the spear, there's a smile when it starts to work. Maybe a smirk at Malik, and this fear when Malik is advancing towards him. Both of those are seen. He can see Muawiyah, and he's advancing towards him, striking his swords against the soldiers of Muawiyah, advancing towards Muawiyah. He can see that. Someone comes from Amir al-Mu'mineen, says, Malik, Ali ibn Abi Talib tells you, come back. Now, put yourself in that position. You are on the verge of a victory that you have worked so hard to accomplish. You have lost so many comrades, perhaps family members, to accomplish. And you are that close to accomplishing it. You're not at the beginning of the battle. You are that close to accomplishing it, to attaining that goal, to get there, to have Muawiyah taken care of. entirely. And then besides the personal feelings that Malik should have as a person, a human being has, of wanting that victory, you're that close. You don't want to let go when you're that close. Even on video games, as parents, parents experience this with children and with their teenagers. And as teenagers or as youngsters, when I was also, we experienced this. If we're winning a game, we're playing a game. If anybody disturbs us in that game, it depends where we are in that game. If we're at the beginning, we just started. Okay, it's not too bad. All right, get up, do your homework. All right, just leave and go. But if you're about to win a very crucial level on that game, very critical point, you're about to win it. Mom or dad comes and says, you need to get up, do this. There's no way on earth you're going to get up. It's so difficult. It's so difficult. This is just a video game. It's not something which is really serious in life. Malik is that close to win this battle. And besides the personal motives or incentives here, there's another element, which is that Muawiyah is such an Iblis, such a shaitan, such an evil figure, and has created so much hardship for the Ummah, so much hardship for the Imam, all these things. Just a couple more strikes of the sword, I'll get rid of Muawiyah, that'll be it. How many of you guys would think that it's a good idea? Let's not respond to the call of Amir al-Mu'minin. Let's continue. You know how bad Muawiyah is? How many of you are involved with La'an of Muawiyah? When you get to Allahumma la'an Aba Sufyana wa Muawiyah wa Yazid ibn Muawiyah in Ziyarat Ashura, you say it with a lot of passion because of when you remember who Muawiyah was and what he did. There's this rage and hatred against what he did and who he was, the problems he created for Amir al-Mu'mineen, for Imam al-Mujtaba, for the Prophet. Very strong feelings against him. Imagine yourself there. You have a couple more strikes of the sword. You're going to get to Muawiyah and get rid of Muawiyah. But then the Imam sends a messenger. Malik, stop. It's very difficult for a person at that stage to say, okay, I'm going to stop. I'm going to come back. Malik did this. Malik did this. Although he could see Muawiyah, and perhaps when Muawiyah saw the messenger telling him to come back, Muawiyah had a smirk on his face, laughing at him. Look at you. We beat you guys. Malik can see that. But he turns back. Ali says, come back. He didn't come back because he had fear that they're going to kill Ali. Those are not the reasons. Ali said to come back. Said, okay, I'll come back. I'll leave that victory. I don't want a victory that Ali does not want. Before I explain that bit, let me explain something that is a little more difficult perhaps to see here, and which was what I was initially explaining about Malik. Malik at this point has reached a point in his development where he sees the Imam as someone whose words are different than an ordinary person. And his words need to be obeyed, whatever they are. Even if, according to your understanding, you don't see things the way he does, you should say, I'm wrong and he's right. This is very important, very important. At this point, Malik sees that. Otherwise, Malik, as an ordinary person, as a person that's in that particular scene, advancing towards Muawiyah, he could have easily said, Ali doesn't know what he's talking about. Let me get rid of Muawiyah. He'll thank me later. You'll start saying these things. You'll start thinking in this way. If you don't see Ali's words as something that is different, if Ali says, come back, he knows the conditions. Don't think he doesn't know. Don't say he doesn't know where I am. Just a couple more strikes of the sword. Ali said to come back now. Don't tell yourself he doesn't know my conditions. It's Ali. It's not someone else. It's not an average person. It's not someone who doesn't have knowledge of the unseen. It's someone who knows everything. He's telling me to come back. Before, there's another scene in Siffin, towards the beginning of the battle. Amir al-Mu'mineen commanded him to do something. Malik didn't see it the way Amir al-Mu'mineen saw it. He disagreed with him. And he didn't do what Amir al-Mu'mineen told him. At the initial part of the battle, that's how he saw Ali ibn Abi Talib. But that changed. That changed. This point, he's seeing Ali ibn Abi Talib as someone that whatever he says is right. That's one thing. But then after you identify Ali ibn Abi Talib, what he says is right, but I'm going to lose this battle. I've worked so hard for it. And I'm so close to winning it. Nafs comes in and you don't want to obey the person that you know knows more than you. Malik stepped on his nafs. I don't want a victory that Amir al-Mu'mineen doesn't want. For whatever reason that I don't understand, Ali ibn Abi Talib says, it doesn't matter how close you are to Muawiyah, come back, stop fighting. This is not a time to fight. This is a very important lesson for us, brothers and sisters, especially those of us who are involved with the movement, are politically, socially involved, they're activists, they're working hard to accomplish goals that they have identified to be Islamic goals. They're trying to serve the Imam. This is very important for everyone, but especially those. Why? Many times we get involved with these activities. We get involved with activism. We get involved with setting up programs, protests. We don't realize, but the objective changes. The goal changes. The goal isn't really that we want to work for the Imam of our time. The goal isn't really that we want to do what the Imam wants, what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants. What's the sign? One of the signs is that if something comes up, leadership tells us pull back, we're not willing to pull back. We're not willing to pull back. Like, but this, but that, excuses, this. We're not willing to pull back. There are times that in a movement, things, different things happen, different conditions arise and conditions change. And then so the measures that are going to be taken should change. Amir al-Mu'mineen was the one who went for the battle. At this point, he's the one who says stop. The same one who said start fighting. We need to go and fight Muawiyah. Prepared an army. Did all of that. Is now saying stop. The conditions were such that they should have fought. They did fight. The conditions changed. Amir al-Mu'mineen says now is not the time to fight. Even if we're that close. Killing Muawiyah now means nothing. No, stop. don't continue, don't proceed. Conditions change. If we are involved with that activity for even the slightest amount other than for Allah, other than for the Imam of our time, other than obeying the Imam of our time and doing things for him, when those conditions change, we're not willing to stop. The battle, the fight, is not for Allah. The battle is for the nafs. Engaging, involving in social activism, in political activism, in going to protests, is not Allah. It's the nafs. I like to be involved. I like to be seen. I like to be in the spotlight. Initially, the reason I engaged were good reasons, Islamic reasons. I joined the battle for those reasons. I heard all these great speeches, great talks. I heard of great figures. I've heard of the contemporary figures, whether the scholarly figures like Imam Khomeini or the political activists like Malcolm X, or in other arenas and the battlefield, some of the great commanders of Islam, Shahid Hajj Imad Mughniya, Qasim Soleimani, we hear Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, we hear all these great figures and get excited, and we want to get involved with activism, want to do things, want to fight the Tawhud, want to fight the enemies of Islam. So we start engaging, make media programs, multimedia programs, clips, Facebook accounts, and start posting all this stuff. Initially, we got involved for what reason? For those things, we heard those great things. We heard of Malik, and what a great asset he was to Amir al-Mu'mineen. We wanted to be like that. Eventually, being the center of attention, being someone that people go to, being someone that accomplishes, becomes a goal, and it creeps its way. It doesn't suddenly just present itself where you can recognize, oh, this is something different. No, it creeps its way. It's gradual. It's a gradual process. Eventually, it's no longer Allah. It's no longer the Imam of our time. So when the time comes that the command comes from the Imam through the leader of the movement in his absence, in the absence of the Imam, to stop, we're not willing to stop. I will have all the justifications. I hope we're able to maintain the sincerity that we have, hopefully, or we had when we started, when we engaged in the path of serving the cause of the Imam of our time, serving Islam. And I hope and pray that more than that, we resemble Malik. Malik made progress. Some of us digressed. He made progress. He went from where he didn't have the Imam in mind. He didn't know. He didn't listen to the Imam in that way because he didn't see him in that way. He didn't go to rebel against Uthman because Amir al-Mu'mineen told him to. He was fed up with the governors of Uthman, with a bunch of other people. They went to Medina and they didn't go straight to Amir al-Mu'mineen and ask him what they should do. He didn't, because he didn't see that. But he made progress. He started seeing Ali ibn Abi Talib in that way. And he started listening to him. Whatever he said, the most difficult time is this one, I believe, from the history that's available to us, of course. When Amir al-Mu'mineen told him, stop, at that point in time, that was a very difficult decision to make, to stop and come back. Malik obeyed. Malik obeyed. I hope that, inshallah, we take that on board from Malik, and we're able to make that progress instead of digressing, instead of moving backwards, instead of turning away from the Imam, from the direction of Islam, and so on and so forth, inshallah. Sallallahu alayka ya Aba Abdullah. Sallallahu alayka ya Mazlum. Ayyuha al-Shahid bi Karbala. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon you, my beloved Imam al-Hussein. The Imam was slaughtered by the shores of the Euphrates while his mouth was dry of thirst. Ruhi fidaka ya Mawlai. Brothers and sisters, let's try to remember the family of Imam al-Hussein, Imam Zain al-Abidin, the Lady Zainab, Rubam, Sakina, the other young ones, all the women and children, all they've seen after the day of Ashura is disrespect and torture. Ya Allah, perhaps one of the most difficult things that the family had to deal with on the way to Sham was not the torture itself, the way they treated the but were the memories of Karbala. Every time the mother of Ali and al-Asghar had fluids and felt she had milk to nurse Asghar, the memory of her son, I don't know what she saw with the last time, when the last time was that she saw him. Some say Imam al-Hussein, after Ali al-Asghar was shot in the neck, did not return the baby to the tent. Rather, he went somewhere where the women could not see and buried the child. Or perhaps, according to others, maybe she saw something, and every time she felt she had milk for him. I don't know how she dealt with those memories. Ala la'natullah ala al-qawm al-zalimeen. Wa say'alamu al-lazina zalamu wa yamun qalabin yanqalibun ya Hussein.
Ya Hussein, Ya Hussein, Ya Hussein, Ya Hussein. Ya Hussein, Ya Hussein, Ya Hussein, Ya Hussein.
O my Imam Zainul Abidin, O my Imam Zainul Abidin, O Sajjad, you taught us the art of supplication, you showed us the power of frustration. To make Islam our life's foundation, and how to ask Allah for salvation. Such is your status, O holy soul. You made Allah's love your only goal. Oh, my mom, Zainul Abidin. Oh, Sajjad, you are the great grandson of Muhammad. Inside your veins flow the purest of blood. You came down from heaven like a rosebud and left your scent forever in this world. Your name will live on forever now. Till death you'll be in our hearts we bow. Oh, my mom, Zainul Abidin. Oh, Sajjad, you saw your father's head on that spear, your mother's bareheaded and in fear. Your sister was treated so severe, that blood was pouring down from her ear. And yet you were so brave that you spoke, and in the courtyard the world awoke. Oh, my mom, Zainul Abidin.
Oh, my mom, Zainul Abidin.
Oh, Sajjad, with quaking hands, how you dug a small grave, a resting place for Sakina to live. Her shroud was her shirt covered in bloodstains. Till end of time, that is how she will lay. Until today, she's so far from home. The prison's so dark and she's alone. Oh, my mom, Zainul Abidin. Oh, my mom, Zainul Abidin. Oh, Sajjad, Ya Hussein.
Thank you so much, Ayan, for your wonderful recitation of the Noha. Once again, a reminder to us that often after the first 10 days of Muharram, we forget, or not forget as much, but we get so occupied in other aspects of our life. It slips out of our mind that this is when the test of the rest of the Ahlul Bayt began. After the men had sacrificed their lives, laid down their lives to save Islam, to expose the cruelty, we forget that Sayyidah Zainab is called Sharikatul Hussein, that the message of Imam Hussein is not complete without the journey and the trip and the fight and the struggles of Sayyidah Zainab and Imam Sajjad as well. Because upon his return to Medina, when he would cry tears of blood, people would ask him, is Shahadat is a virtue? There's virtue that is present in your family. And he would cry and he would say, there's not Karbala inherently that makes me cry these tears of blood, but the treatment my mother and my sisters and my aunties and the women and the Ahlul Bayt of the Prophet faced at the hands of self-proclaimed Muslimin. So a reminder to myself as much as everyone else to stay connected, to remember that this is still a waqt, like this is still time of musibah on the Ahlul Bayt. I would like to begin again then the question and answer session, Sheikh, if we begin now. I think we'll have plenty of time because we don't have that many questions as of yet. But we shall begin with yesterday's questions, the last of which was related to the ones where they asked you about the faults in the Ummah of Rasulullah. So the last question in that series of questions was, in today's time, how important is it to learn about the behavior of the Ummah in the times of various Imams so that we don't end up being like them? So should we have lectures of series on Ummah of Hazrat Imam Ali alayhi salam, of Imam Hassan alayhi salam, which I suppose like this series sort of does shed light by focusing on certain companions. But that's the question posed to you, Sheikh.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I think two important things need to happen, or two types of themes need to be discussed, thought first and then discussed beyond just lectures, but really discussed to gain clarity. One is the conditions of the time which partially is the what the Ummah did or the conditions of the Ummah were, both of those areas. There are certain things that are the collective conditions of the Ummah in terms of their mindset, in terms of their qualities of collective understanding, collective insight, collective bravery, or the lack of those, or whatever other quality in a collective way that is. That is part of the conditions. It's not the only part of the condition. The other things about the conditions are those within or without the Ummah that were spearheading a movement against Islam. Like the ones who gathered and took what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala had said after the Prophet is Amir al-Mu'mineen. Who were they exactly? How many were they? What were their incentives? And how were they able to pull it off? When you look at their numbers, which is relatively few, as in the leadership of that movement. And then who else played a role in that and why? Understanding all of those are all part of the conditions. Or during the time of the Umayyads, understanding the Umayyads and the rulers, and understanding the Ummah, which is the people. All of that needs to be discussed, and we need to have understandings of that. But besides that whole thing, which is the conditions, another part which is more important, and unfortunately it is less attended to, I believe, I can say, in terms of seriously looking at this and analyzing, is what the imams did in each of those conditions. We have part of it. Obviously, we know what Fatimatu Zahra did in terms of after the demise of the Prophet, going out to the masjid about Fadak. We hear those things standing behind the door. We hear those things going to the masjid again when Amir al-Mu'mineen was taken for the allegiance. We hear those things going to Uhud, crying, the cries being heard. When they want to come and apologize, she turns away from them. These are things that we hear, but and we know of. What exactly is she trying to do with all of this? That's the part we haven't spent much time understanding, analyzing. And so what exactly was she doing with regards to Fadak? What exactly was she doing by standing behind the door? What exactly was she doing joining Amir al-Mu'mineen, going to the doors of the Ansar? What was Amir al-Mu'mineen doing during that time, the period between the burial ceremony, which took a few days, and Amir al-Mu'mineen was involved in that, and the days after? So those few days, Amir al-Mu'mineen was not involved. Things started happening. Why did Amir al-Mu'mineen not get involved? Despite knowing through people telling him, besides the knowledge of an imam, why? What was he trying to do with that? And when they did go to the doors of the Ashab, what was he trying to do with that? When they didn't come, why did he choose not to fight? Why did he choose not to fight when they behaved at his door the way they did? Fatimatu Zahra went behind the door. He was there. And this happened. Amir al-Mu'mineen is there. Why did he not do anything? What's he trying to do with that? These are things that we have not spent time analyzing. Imam al-Hussein, we don't know. We just know he went to Karbala. He was martyred. He said, I'm not going to pledge allegiance to Yazid. Well, then why did he pledge allegiance to, in a sense, the what is called bay'ah? Allegiance has a slightly different meaning. He was in the treaty, the treaty that Imam al-Mujtaba had with Muawiyah. They did it. Is Muawiyah better than Yazid? Or is he worse than Yazid? In many ways, Muawiyah is worse. And why was there a treaty with Muawiyah but not with Yazid? What's the difference here? Why is it that the stance there is that, and afterwards it's this? And then Imam Zain al-Abidin, and so on. So there's a lot that needs to be discussed in terms of what were the imams trying to do. Let's try to understand. So if we understand the conditions that they had, and then we understand how they behaved in the face of those conditions, that will give us a complete understanding of, once we identify what our conditions are, relate them to those times, and then see what the imams did, identify what we need to do based on that. If we only look at the conditions and what the Ummah did, we don't know what the response of the imam was exactly. We haven't understood it properly. So even if we understand the conditions right now, all we're going to be doing is just nagging about how the ummah is this or that. Well, that's not the objective. The objective is to learn what to do. It doesn't matter if the ummah is this or that. The imams functioned in the most devastating of times, the most difficult of times. The imams did not stop functioning. They did not stop leading. They did not stop their movement towards Allah and moving the ummah, the same ummah that has all these faults and flaws. The imams had never stopped guiding and moving forward with these conditions. So what's important is to identify those conditions, not to sit down and cry only, not to sit down and say, oh, there were bad people, there were this, there were that, or to find those and then be like, this person is like this person in history, or that person is like the other person in history, and the ummah is bad and this, that. That's not going to get us anywhere. What's going to get us somewhere is once we understand what the problems were in the ummah, try for ourselves not to have them, and then see what the imam's solution is. Well, the fact is there are these problems. So how did the imams function in those times? The notion that they didn't take stances, they didn't do anything, Amir al-Mu'mineen stood at home for 25 years, didn't do anything, is incorrect. That's not really what happened. We need to identify what they did so that once we understand today what our conditions are, which of the imams we are similar to, we can look at that time and then see what the imam did and learn from that and start doing what the imam did.
You're absolutely correct, because as they were leaders in their personal and religious aspects, where we can learn from them on how to deal with people on an individual level, obviously they were political leaders, and maybe it is one of the mistakes that we make, that we separate religion and politics at times, where we feel like, you know, their conflict with those people was like because of a divine perspective, or because, you know, somebody was an oppressor and the imam was on haq. We forget, or we don't seem to learn as much from the political know-how and knowledge of our imam in order to benefit as much as we can and to relate to our modern times. And which kind of ties into it, the next question that was asked yesterday. It goes to say, serving the cause of the imam of our time usually has broad meanings. So what is the most important activity youth can get involved in the West to serve the cause of Imam al-Mahdi ajalallahu ta'ala faraja? Or what is the biggest obstacle to the reappearance of the imam of our time because of us?
The biggest obstacle is the ignorance of people, their lack of knowledge. People, the majority of the people of the world who are going to be the that will need to support the imam of our time. If he is going to be governing them, they need to support him. Well, the majority of the people of the world right now don't even know him to support him. They don't know Islam. They have misunderstandings of Islam. They think Islam is a backwards religion at best, or a terrorist religion at worst. So other areas of ignorance as well, ignorance in regards to their political systems. A lot of people think that their political systems are good. They've made accomplishments and advancements. They're first world countries because of their governments and so on. And so they should support their governments. All these ignorances are some of them, the deceptions of the rulers that have caused masses to develop these wrong understandings. This is the biggest obstacle. And it has so many different areas for people to work in terms of trying to help in changing that. But before anything, there's not time-wise, meaning that's something to work on. But what's more important, what I mean by before anything, is this in terms of priority and importance, is our own development. Which means that if we are only focused on the outside and the ignorance and the ummah and this and that, all external elements, we lose sight of ourselves and our own development. What's the primary concern of each of us should be our own development in the goal of the Imam in coming and establishing that whole government of the global divine government of the Imam is to help people progress towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We already know that. We already have that available to us. If we leave that, if we turn away from that and say we want to work on this field or that field for the Imam of our time to come, well, we're not helping in his direction. It's not going to help, because we, with our problems and lack of development, will become the ones that will have those problems. Again, Zubayr is a good, bad example for us. It's a good person to look at as a bad example, bad role model. You don't want to be like him. He's someone that believed in Amir al-Mu'mineen ruling and so on, but eventually he became the problem. He became the enemy of the Imam or some of the others that are there. We've seen that in history. The ones who usurped the right of Amir al-Mu'mineen after the demise of the Prophet were people that were with the Prophet from an early stage of the development of Islam. They were there. They were involved in the battles. Not the bravest of fighters, but they were there. They were in those battles. They took part in those battles. So we can easily, if we neglect ourselves and neglect our own development while we're working on doing whatever it is for Islam, awareness, creating awareness, changing the perception of people towards Islam, towards the Ahlul Bayt, towards the Quran, towards the Prophet, towards the current Muslim leaders, towards Islam in the contemporary state of it. While we're working on that, if we don't develop ourselves, then we are probably going to end up becoming the problem and obstacle in the way of the Imam. Those are two areas that I think I can emphasize on working on.
Okay, so you'd suggest reflection and accountability, basically, to learn from the past. And another question now from relating to today's session. It's more of a historical thing. It says, was Malik Ashtar a companion of Imam on his own, or was his whole tribe followers of the Ahlul Bayt as well?
I have not seen any evidence of the whole of his tribe being followers of Amir al-Mu'mineen. There's another companion that seems to be a companion of Amir al-Mu'mineen, and that is Kumail ibn Ziyad al-Nakhai. He's also Nakhai. So, and then the other thing is that in Kufa, there were many people that were supporters of Amir al-Mu'mineen, some more, some less. But in terms of the whole tribe, I'm not sure. I don't recall any type of evidence suggesting to me that the whole tribe was or wasn't. I'm not sure.
Okay, and then again, leading on to the personality of Hazrat Malik Ashtar, it says, other than chivalry, what other quality of Malik Ashtar can we draw inspiration from?
The one we were trying to discuss, which I'm not sure if I was able to get across or not, is not his chivalry. It was his taqwa, his divine incentive in fighting. You have good fighters at times. And even Malik himself, before the Battle of Siffin, was also a great fighter. He was a great warrior. He was known for that. The difference is that at that point in Siffin, he developed into a person who was able to use his skill in the way of Allah and only in the way of Allah, and not be driven by anything but what pleases Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. That is way more important than his chivalry in the battle. Him returning to Amir al-Mu'mineen because of his taqwa, obeying Amir al-Mu'mineen at that point, that battle that he had to internally fight there and step on his nafs and kill his nafs and say, no, I'm not going to listen to you. I'm going to listen to Ali. I'm going to go back. That is way more difficult and a lot more, in a sense, chivalry, but not in that battlefield, in the physical, material battlefield, but in the battlefield of the nafs, the soul, the spiritual battlefield, that the Holy Prophet, when the people were returning from a battle during his time, he greeted them by saying greetings to the people who are returning from the smaller battle. He said, smaller battle. This was the smaller battle. What's the greater battle? The Prophet said the greater battle is the battle of the self, the nafs. What Malik did there was a victory in the battle of the nafs that was much greater than slaying Muawiyah, what he did there at that point. Ali says, come back, you listen to that. And perhaps it was, I'm not sure if it was after Safin, maybe some of these qualities were developed before as well. But what we discussed there in regards to his decision to turn back, that is, again, I'm not sure if I was able to, or if I can really get across what type of test this was and the ability for Malik to pass this test and do the right thing, make the right decision. That is very different than the example I'm about to put forth, but this is also an example of the taqwa of Malik, where the story I think many of us have heard, and especially people who have the ability. Certain people are cowards, or they're incapable of even defending themselves. That's one thing. But if you have full ability to take care of yourself against really strong enemies, and then some random person that is frustrated with whatever gets angry at you and shows you attitude one way or another. The example we have is a young guy in Kufa disrespected Malik by spitting on him. If you're, we can't take, forget about that level of attitude and disrespect. Just a slight word that's off, we cannot take it, and it turns into a whole rivalry or a whole scene that we have to make sure, how dare this person say this, or you got to take that. I got to show something. Malik, this great man, this great warrior, he's got every ability. Who's this young little dude doing this? There's nothing for him to take care of him. And who is there to stand? But he just puts his head down, goes to the masjid, doesn't even respond. Does not even respond. Not out of arrogance. There's a time where a person feels somebody hit him, they just look, and they're just like, oh, who the heck is this? Forget this. Let's move on. That's out of arrogance. That's a different scenario. It's a different type of thing. Mali put his head down, went to the masjid, and then people told the young boy, the young man, rather, do you know who this was? Do you know what exactly you did? And he goes to the masjid to find him, to apologize, thinking of, oh my God, he's going to take this out on me at some point. He goes to the masjid and sees Malik is praying for him. That means Malik has attained a status that his nafs is under his control. He's not commanded by these feelings, these emotions of anger, of fear, of... No, he sees what Allah wants in this condition. If Allah wants all these muscles and all the skills with the sword to not be consumed and for me not to use them and put the sword and leave it in, put my head down like a coward, look like a coward to some people, maybe even they said a few things about him, and leave, if that's what God wants, I don't want to do. That is what I try to focus on. That is something that we need to learn from Malik. The chivalry in the battlefield is not for all. Not everybody is going to be that. Not everybody is going to be a capable person in the battlefield. Zainab salamullahi alayha is a woman. She's not supposed to be a capable person in the battlefield. Not that no women can be. Zainab wasn't. There were some women that at some times, even during the time of the Prophet, they were in the battlefield. Some women have that, but many women don't. The chivalry of Zainab was not the sword in the battlefield. It was the sharpness and the blade of her speech. Her blade is her speech. If somebody has got that taqwa, that self-development, and they're wanting to do things based on what Allah wants, then whatever assets they have, whatever resources available to them, whether it's physical strength in the battlefield, it's a skill with a sword, with a gun, a skill with orchestrating a battlefield, managing people in the battlefield, leading people, leadership positions, or it's something completely different in terms of software development, in electronics, in medicine, in whatever it is that a person has. God has given different people different talents. If one has taqwa, they will use their talent in the way of Allah, and Allah will give them an opportunity. That will be their battlefield, where they proceed, where they take steps, which is like using the sword. And when do they decide that, no, the sword is going in, and we're going to listen to Ali ibn Abi Talib? No, we're not going to continue fighting, although we're that close to winning this battle. So the more important thing to learn from Malik is not his skills in the battlefield, rather his taqwa, his sincerity, his ability to control his nafs and not to do with those temptations, strong and for many of us justified feelings, is able to step all over that. That is something that I envy.
Yeah, no, there is plenty to learn from us and from them for us. And the next question kind of focuses away from the personality of Malik Ashtar himself. It goes to ask, we have heard quite frequently about Kufis and their behavior in various times. Can you please shed some light on the people of Basra, as Basra was another relatively politically active city in those times, and which players or which people were playing a role there?
Before Basra, let me actually say something about Kufa that I feel is a lot of times misunderstood. From my understanding of how we as Shia feel towards the people of Kufa is that we sort of feel like these are the worst people. I've even heard, like, when they want to say a city is the worst city, like, this is like Kufa. This city is like Kufa, the worst city. The fact is, Kufa was the only place that wanted the Imam to come. Kufa was the only place that the Imam had supporters. Medina didn't have supporters for Imam Hussein. Mecca didn't have supporters for Imam Hussein. Yemen didn't have supporters for Imam Hussein. Sham didn't have, Egypt didn't have, nowhere. It was Kufa. When things are said about Kufa, it needs to be understood that these were the best of the people. The problem is, it is expected from you to do A, B, C, and you didn't. And then let's analyze why they didn't. Why? Because once you understand it in that light, then hopefully we are trying to be like the companions of the Imam and people who want the Imam to come. And we need to look at Kufa as an example for us. That if you're claiming that you're waiting for the Imam, if you're wanting for the Imam to come, if out of all the people of the world, you who identify as Shia are the only ones that say to the Imam, please come, remember, the people of Kufa were the only ones that told Imam al-Hussein to come. And look what they did. Make sure you don't make that same mistake. Learn from them. Okay. We should always remember that Kufa is the only place that was expected to have done anything good. Other places, there was even no expectation. They were all below the standard of Kufa. Kufa was at a standard that it was expected to have behaved differently. So for us, we need to look at that in that way and hopefully learn from that. Basra was actually very similar, although it wasn't the same. In the Battle of Jamal, which was related, which was right outside Basra, the Kufans came and supported. Basra was split. When Talha, Zubayr, and Aisha went to Basra, some of the people of Basra, some of the tribes actually supported them. That's why they had a very large army to fight Amir al-Mu'mineen. On the other side, of course, there were those who supported Amir al-Mu'mineen. The governor that Amir al-Mu'mineen had appointed for Basra fought against them, and there were those who supported him. And those tribes who went with the rebellion against Amir al-Mu'mineen, they attacked some of the people of Basra, the tribes of Basra, first and foremost. So the city was split. You had those who were not in support of and actually supported the rebellion against Amir al-Mu'mineen. And then there were those who were supporters of Amir al-Mu'mineen. Some of those who lost their lives in support of Amir al-Mu'mineen to try to help guide the other tribes towards Amir al-Mu'mineen when they made the decision to join the opposition and to join the rebellion against Amir al-Mu'mineen. That's roughly the demographics of Basra. In regards to Karbala, and that particular incident, Imam al-Husayn wrote a letter to the people of Basra as well. At the time, Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad was actually the governor of Basra. In Kufa, Nu'man ibn Bashir was the governor. Before Yazid sent him to Kufa, Ubaydullah was in Basra. The letter arrived in Basra, and the person that it was sent to thought that this might be a plot from Ubaydullah. He didn't think that this is a real messenger from Imam Hussein. He sent the messenger to Ubaydullah thinking that this is a spy. Then he realized it wasn't. It was actually a messenger. Things panned out really badly over there. The messenger got killed over there, was martyred over there in Basra. Different things happened over there. But people of Basra got wind of this happening. So a number of them got ready to join Imam al-Hussein. And by the time they made it out, the ones who decided to go, by the time they made it out, they went, they got the news that Imam Hussein has been martyred. So we had companions in Basra as well, of Imam Hussein, those who supported, those who came to join him. But by the time they got out, the battle was over, and they didn't get to join the battle. But they were there in spirit, of course.
Okay. This next question is more towards an academic side. It says, would you please recommend any books that we can read to learn about the special companions of the various Imams alayhim salam?
Unfortunately, there's barely anything to read about the Imams themselves, much less the companions in the English language. I hope that there's more work written or translated in the English language that we can recommend. That has this. There's a book on history that is about 8 volumes. It's in Arabic. I hope that at some point that is translated. That will be a good resource for anyone. And it's written by a good scholar. It's very detailed. And so it gives you a lot of material to read if that is translated. Unfortunately, it's not translated. The only works that I know of that have been translated are related to the Imams. They don't focus on the companions. Obviously, there's some mention of the companions, but there's no focus on those companions. And out of those books that have been translated, there's one of them that is more recent. I don't remember the title of the book, actually. It could be found on Amazon, The Lives of the Imams or something along those lines. The author of it was written originally in Farsi by an author by the name of Pishvoi, and it was translated by, I think Sayyid Ali Musavi is the name of the brother who translated it. four volumes, and it covers all of the imams. Four smaller volumes, of course, not like the big history work that I was talking about. This is what's available, inshallah. We hope that in the near future, there's other work that is available for people who are interested to read.
Yeah, absolutely, because I feel like a lot of the youth in the West, they sort of need the material. It's that we have a lack of access, and then, you know, the disconnect doesn't help either. The next question we have here is that we hear a lot about Qasim Soleimani, Harith Qasim Soleimani, as a Maliki Ashtar of the current era. So is he a good role model to be followed in our times?
Yes, but again, similar to what we said regarding Malik himself, what is important about Harith Qasim Soleimani is not him being a commander in the battlefield. He was, what we can all learn from him is his taqwa, his insight, his ability to control his nafs. In that area, there's a lot of different examples of the same type of idea that was mentioned about Malik and him having control of his nafs. While he was, Haj Qasim was a military commander, he was a very soft person, which is very rare to find. Amir al-Mu'mineen is the climax of that, the softest and harshest person at the same time, the combination of contradicting qualities, harshness and softness. Amir al-Mu'mineen is the softest and the harshest, depending on who it's against. At the same time that he has that harshness against the enemies of Islam, unwavering will against them, slaying so many of the enemies of Islam without any negative feelings about it, any fear or any thoughts afterwards, should I have done this? No. He slayed Abtal al-Arab, as we have in Qatala Abtalahum in Dua Nudba. The heroes of the Arabs were slain by the hands of Ali ibn Abi Talib, salamullahi. Harshness there that you see. The softness that he cannot take an orphan not having bread or even something to play with, and he goes and spends that time, that softness that he humbles himself, plays with the children, gets all those children to smile. Amir al-Mu'mineen, on a level that is unattainable to us, we look at that and we try to get as close as we can. We see that this is a man that, to the best of his ability, and compared to a lot of others that we know, was able to attain greatness. While he was very, the enemies of Islam were scared to death of the guy, and they were so angry at him that they plotted this killing, this assassination that backfired on them. That's how angry they were because of what he was able to, the setbacks that he had caused them with his harshness towards them, the unwavering will against them. At the same time, look at the children in those areas that were free from ISIS, whether it was him or his comrade, close friend, a great believer, Ajabu Mahdi al-Muhandis, another great man. He also shared those qualities. Look at them with the children they freed. They're not even Muslim, like Yazidi people over there. They're not Muslim. Christian people, Assyrian people, the children, they go to those areas, they free those people from Daesh who claim to be Muslim but behave completely against Islam. And the way they deal with these children, the softness you can see in these people is amazing. This is, or being able to, again, step on one's nafs, one's desires. There are some accounts that are very interesting, but in the interest of time, I think I will skip on that.
Okay. So maybe if we can make time for it in the future, you can share them with us and enlighten us with further knowledge. Unfortunately, I think that is the end of the questions that have been asked today. So I'd like to thank you again for spending so much time and then in such great detail as well. shedding light on certain aspects that were neglected or unknown to us as well. And on top, I'd also like to thank Brother Hussein Mehdi for his recitation of the Holy Quran, Brother Khurshid Abbas for his recitation of the Salam, and Brother Ayan Mirza as well for his recitation of the Noha. Thank you so much, Sheikh, again for your wonderful lecture. And we hope to gain more from you tomorrow. And I would urge everyone again to join us same time between 6 to 7:30 p.m. at Dublin time. And any questions that may arise, any questions that you're holding on to, please do send them to us. And inshallah, hoping to see everyone tomorrow. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you.
Thank you.